Wait. Ba-ba-da-da.
Oh boy, everybody. We made it.
I'm sweating.
Oh man, speaking of sweat, something that I
Wow.
wanted to update y'all on is I got my humidifier working.
Ooh.
Yes, it was excellent. I got to use a soldering iron. I forget
Fun.
where I left the story off last time, but
We were
basically I
debating
had.
whether you were going to blow up a $6 humidifier
Yes.
by
Okay.
electricity.
Yes. No, I remember now. So yeah, I got the humidifier and I did not have the correct voltage and amperage for the charge, like power adapter. So what I did was I went back to the thrift store and I found a charger that had close enough to the specifications that I needed. And I was super excited, so I bought it for $3, and then I went home and I then tried to plug it into the humidifier, and the connector was the wrong size.
Amazing.
Yep. So there's like different diameters of these kinds of connectors. They're all like the same connector. I don't know why they have different sizes. Probably just so that you can't accidentally interchange them. That if they're too different. But
Like,
anyway,
how not correct was it? Like,
it did not go into the slot.
well, I understand that, but like visually, would it, like in hindsight, was it fairly obvious, or were you still kind of like, oh dang, I totally thought that was going to fit?
I totally thought it was gonna. It was the difference between like 5 millimeters and 7 millimeters.
You forgot your calipers.
I did. I actually don't have calipers. I should get some.
That's actually kind of surprising.
Anyway, then I just went to my local hardware store because I thought, okay, there's got to be some sort of adapter that I could get where I could just plug it in and they would just be an obnoxiously long connector to plug in, but at least I could plug it in. And it turns out that they did not have this, and the only way I could get one was to order a pack online, which would give me every single combination, which I did not need. I just needed the one, but you can't buy just the one. So instead, what I did is I, at the hardware store, I bought just a replacement tip for one of these power cables.
Just the tip.
Oh yeah,
Nice.
I bought just the tip. And then, but what I then occurred to me after I bought it is I looked at the inside and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I need to solder this on. Because it's the idea is that you could take one of these and if you had like accidentally broken off the end of it or if it had the co cables had frayed or something, and I do not have a soldering iron, again something that I would love to have available, but what I did have is a friend who works in an actual physical lab, like it's an optics lab, but they have a soldering iron in the physics building, so I just asked him if I could go in and use it for a little bit, and he's like, yeah, no problem. And so I went in. It was fun. I'd watched a video on how to do this just before, but it went super well. It was a little bit like nerve-wracking at first when I was working with it because it's been a long time since I've worked with solder, and it's just so weird to have something that just immediately solidifies as soon as you're not touching it into whatever shape it was when you like lifted the iron off. But yeah, it was good. I got to also use some heat shrink wrap to solidify it, and then tested it out, and it works just in time for the weather to not be dry anymore.
That's the best way to end that story. Just in time for me to not need this thing that I've been working on for weeks, but now I have
Months.
it.
Yeah. I'll have it for next year, though.
That's true. It's like
Yeah.
getting, I was just talking about this today. It's like getting a really nice, like a good, really a good deal on a really nice coat in May. You're like, well, now I have it
Yes.
for next year. It's gonna be great.
Yeah, exactly. Like, seasonal stuff, it's always the cheapest to buy it when it's not the season. or when the season's ending. I forget. I don't know. You know what I mean.
For those listening at home, Mikhail just got briefly sidetracked during his own response because he was actively editing the show notes and rearranging stories for coherence while he was talking, which is impressive.
I don't know if I would have come up with the words better if I wasn't doing that.
That's true. That's we don't have no counterfactual. We will never know.
Yeah.
All right, Mikhail, you got to not see the sun. Oh, we switched the order. Oh, no. I'm all thrown
I was
off.
Trying to be subtle about it, but...
Okay, fine. Then I'll do a different segue. Jack, I'm looking at this keyboard that you want to buy, and I'm annoyed because now I want it.
Yes. So, for people listening at home, I don't know what section of our podcast to actually put this in because it is not a corner case corner. Maybe I'll discover some once I have the keyboard, but let's hope not. Knock on wood. My company, because so much of our company is fully remote, 60% of the company is fully remote. And as a result, they have all these benefits for people being remote, basically because they don't have to pay for office space for us. And one of those benefits is an annual recurring office stipend. And so once a year, I have to come up with what I want to spend an office stipend on. And it's like $250. So I'm like, oh, I got to get some stuff. And I already have a full setup, obviously, because why wouldn't I have a full setup? I work from home. I have to survive somehow. And so I am getting this amazing fancy keyboard from Keychron, which is a brand that one of my wife's coworkers put me onto because he is far more into it than I am. But he turned me onto this brand, and I am going to get this fancy pseudo-split professional mechanical keyboard with a goofy layout, and I'm very excited about it. It's going to probably be really annoying for at least like a week or so, but then it'll be great. Then it'll be awesome.
Yeah.
I'm currently using a Keychron keyboard. I actually sent Grant a Keychron keyboard a while ago because he had been interested in mechanical keyboards. So I can vouch for Keychron in general. Excellent. As well. But yes, this interests me because I tend to switch between the Keychron that I currently use, which is the K3. So it is it has a similar net layout here in terms of like number of overall keys. It doesn't have the modifier, doesn't have like a dial, but it's much more compact. Like it is put onto a rectangular grid completely
with no extra space on it. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so it's, I'm like, used
not,
to it
not
now
even a buffer on the outside,
and the keycaps are low profile, which I actually really like, versus this one looks like they're going to be more full-sized keycaps. But anyways, yeah, so I switch between the Keychron, like I'll use this for like a month or two, and then I'll switch back to my Microsoft Sculpt or whatever it's called, which is the like wavy Microsoft split finger or split hand keyboard, where it's the same thing where it's like it's split. Like you do have to kind of like have your hands in separate places. It's more aggressively split than this, and there's like a curve to it, like a contour to it. So, but this one seems like it could be a fun little best of both worlds situation for me to consider.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very into keyboards. I've never really had a nice mechanical keyboard, but I have become frustrated. This is something we'll touch on in more depth later in the show, but I am moving from my current role where typing is obviously an important part of my job, but maybe not that critical that I do it that effectively, into a more technical role where I will actually be writing code and writing documentation potentially. And as a result, I was like, well, this timing kind of lines up with my stipend, and I have nothing else to spend it on, and I am annoyed with typing on my MacBook Pro's keyboard and using that as like my primary keyboard while I'm working. I'm just tired of that. But I decided, rather than just like buying like a cheap Logitech Bluetooth keyboard or something, I'm just going to go big. If I'm going to have a pile of cash handed to me, then I'm going to go big and I'm going to get a nice keyboard. Because why would I not? Although I don't take it as seriously as my wife's keyboard my wife's coworker who turned me on to Keychron, because he bought, they have this thing on their site to test out the switches. You can get like a, what is it? It's like a...
It's a switch tester. I mean, it's like, what, four or five different keys basically, right?
Oh, it's like...
Or is it more than that?
No, I think it's 10 by 10.
Oh, okay.
So 100 different keys so that you can test out what key you like the most. And I don't know enough to... I trust that there are three options that they default to on the product page. And I'm like, I'm sure those are great. I'm going to pick the one that sounds like what I would want. And that's going to be great. And I won't know the difference. Ignorance is bliss. I'll just have my keyboard.
Which one are you going to pick? Do you know yet? Because I have my strong opinion.
Oh, you have a strong opinion. Well, that's actually very helpful because I don't have a very strong opinion, obviously, because why would I? But when I had looked at them before, we're doing this live, folks. I'm looking down at the... I was going to default to essentially the middle one, which is the brown one. But I don't know what your opinion is. I work from home, and so it doesn't really have to be... It's middle in the sense of the force you apply and the amount of sound, basically. So that it's
brown is the best default for a mechanical keyboard by far.
Amazing.
Reds don't even feel the same. Like they do just feel different, and they're more commonly used for like gamers the way that they are designed. And then blues are like crazy loud. Like they're kind of fun. They're like a fun novelty if you're really into that sort of thing. But man, they're too much most of the time.
Yeah. Keychron says that those would be suitable for a literal typist.
Yeah.
Because they have the highest operating force. So I guess you would, and the highest travel in each key press. So I suppose you would have a very, that would get provide a very tactile feel that would allow you to be the fastest in a sense. Because it's kind of counterintuitive, right? Like the amount of, if there's not enough force or travel, then it's actually harder to type quickly and effectively. Maybe that's a personal preference thing. But, and again, I'm not going to think about it that much. I'm just going to get the middle one. I'm that guy who goes to like, it goes to a store and there's a worst, a middle, and a best. And I'm like, well, middle's probably good enough for me.
Yeah.
Well, who might be getting the best one? Which is just pure psychology. That's just purely, they just want you to buy not the low one. But anyway, that's my small aside about my cool keyboard that I'm excited about.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
so I will,
in this case,
I'll have a follow-up later.
Yeah. In this case, I don't think it's necessarily all that much psychology because the price doesn't change depending on which ones you go with, the red, blue, or brown.
You are right. In this case, it is not. In this case, it's just that they want to provide me with options. But typically, the reason why a place, like when you go to a, I don't know, like a movie and there's a small, medium, and large popcorn is they're banking on some people wanting the large and they want fewer people to get the smalls. And so yeah. they force more people to default to like, well, I'll get the middle one. That seems reasonable.
Yeah.
We've all read Goldilocks.
Well, with popcorn, actually, most of the time, the medium it exists to push people towards the large.
Hmm.
It's like if you don't want any pot, if you want a very small amount, you'll just get a small. And then you look at the medium and it's like, but the large is like $1.50 more. So I guess I'll just get the large. Like, why not?
Right. That's true.
And that's more of what they're doing.
Yeah.
But either way, well, I'm excited for you. I'm excited for you to report back in about 2 months.
Yeah. Yes. I will be getting it in June and then I'll be suffering probably at first. It will probably not be a quick transition, but then I'll get used to it and then it'll be good.
But you're like a good touch typist, you know, like
yes.
People who aren't would have a really tough time. I think you'll probably be just fine.
Yeah, I'll just do a few rounds of Vim Tutor.
You'll just have too much, much fun figuring out what to use those modifier keys for.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I got to figure that out. I got to figure out how I can. Yeah, because there's all these extensions for it. Because I'm in macOS, there's a little bit of a ceiling to customization, but there's still a lot of options out there. There's some stuff I can do. I'll have to look into it. I don't have any strong opinions yet. Stay tuned.
I've been very interested in these sort of split keyboard layouts, and I guess Mark, since you've been using one, I'm wondering if you have any insight into how much it matters. Like, I know that sometimes I will use. I think in this case it has the what's on a QWERTY keyboard. The B key is on both sides. I'm wondering, is that like a pretty common thing to have on the split key? So you don't have to choose one hand to hit the B?
I didn't even notice that. That's fascinating. No, mine is a strict, there's things on, they tell you this is on this side, this is on the other side.
Hmm, interesting.
So I'm pretty sure, now I have to check.
Let me pull out my keyboard because I'm not using it. Oh, it's right here.
Okay, yeah, so on the Microsoft Sculpt, it is the B key is on the left side, and then the N key is like really big.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Like they changed the size of the keys too.
Oh yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the Sculpt is interesting because there is a physical split. So there's two space bars. It's connected on at the wrist, and then there's two space bars, but then there's an actual physical gap between the two sides above the space bars. I'd type in that way.
Interesting. Yeah, so I guess, yeah, so I think, you know, that answers, you know, one question that I had, which is, you know, like, I wonder if that's a common thing for split layouts, and I guess it just depends. But the other thing that I'm noticing, like, yeah, this keyboard that you're looking at, Jack, just doesn't have the numpad, which is something that I think about, because the keyboard that I have is just, I forget where I got it. It was somebody didn't need their Bluetooth keyboard, so I just grabbed it. And it's just the basic sort of Logitech one, but it does have a numpad. And it's something that I think about when because I would like a new keyboard that is better. It's just nice to not have to use the keyboard on my laptop. But that's just the thing I'm wondering, like, do I only think that I need the numpad because I have one and I will use it every once in a while? Or if I didn't have one, do I think I would be just fine using the regular number row?
Really depends, I feel like, on what you do for work. Because in my last job, I was not forced, but like just the nature of what I was doing, there was a lot of like entering data, like essentially taking information that was in like a PDF design and needing to like put numbers into a calculator on our side, or just mm-hmm. transferring numbers from one thing to another. And I had to there's no alternative than to just typing it. And in that case, having a 10 key was really helpful. And because I grew up working at a grocery store, I'm fast with the 10 key. And so in that case, I was like, yeah, I need to have an external keyboard with a 10 key, or else this will actually add hours to the work that I need to do, because there's so much data that I'm entering. But yeah, I think it just really depends on what you're doing. Cause even when you're writing code, yes, you're writing numbers, but like the number row is probably plenty. I mean, unless, I don't know how often you're writing long numbers and needing to do so quickly.
For me, I did also start with a keyboards with numpads. Eventually now I don't ever use them. I actively dislike having a keyboard with a 10 key numpad, because I find it makes me have to put my mouse too far to the right, and I just find that uncomfortable. So for me, it's the width, really. The Microsoft one does come with a separate numpad that you could just put anywhere. Like, it's connected, but you can just put it anywhere you want. You could always get a separate one. That's probably a better option for, like, when you need to break it out, you can break it out. But most of the time, you probably don't need it. And because I've spent so long now without one, I used to be, like, great touch typist on letters, and then I'd have to, like, kind of be checking myself on the number row, either for numbers or special characters. Nowadays, it's like second nature. Like, I'm pretty sure I can type numbers in on the number row with one or two hands about as fast as I could do it on a 10 key numpad, because my brain is just used to it now.
Okay.
Yeah. You can adapt to anything.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think your point about having, you know, the mouse too far to the right is something that I never thought about, but I do think that I notice especially if I'm using my mouse pretty often along with the keyboard and, you know, kind of switching back and forth, I think I do notice that, like, you know, kind of my right shoulder feels a little bit weird to me. That's because I'm kind of moving it out and to the right a bit more than is comfortable.
The last thing I'll mention real quick, which is now probably a reason I won't get this keyboard that Jack is looking at, even though I'm theoretically tempted, is I've become not against, but I really don't like having raised keyboards like this. For ergonomics, it's not actually good to do that. And the thing that the Microsoft Sculpt does is it has, so the wrist rest that's actually on it is comfortable. It has a detachable magnetic wrist stand that goes underneath the keyboard, so that when you're using it, your hands are like, your wrists are kind of like, your arms are up, but your hands are kind of like bent downwards instead of flexed up. And that's like a more neutral, comfortable position for your wrists to be in. So when I use my Keychron, it does have little feet that I could kick out. Right. I don't. I just leave it flat all the time.
Yeah, Mikhail, if you're in the market for a split keyboard, you should look at the absolutely extreme keyboard that I briefly considered, but didn't want to spend twice the amount of money on. But that is like peak, I need to be performant when I'm typing keyboard for insane people, basically.
Oh, my.
Over the years, I've seen lots of LTT likes to look at weird split keyboards. They're so funny, like what people have tried to come up with to make various ergonomic keyboards. It's amazing.
Yeah, Kinesis, this brand is like one of the original ones. And like the big thing that I've heard is like the selling point of these, because there are trade-offs to these. I've heard people complain that like if you have, for instance, smaller than average hands, which I don't have to worry about, but like if people do have smaller than average hands, then like these are kind of, the keys end up being a little more spread out and there's no, you don't get to choose your size. It just is what it is. But I have heard people swear by the fact that, so for listeners at home, this is a split keyboard that's fully split, and the modifier keys, or some of the modifier keys, or like utility keys like backspace, control, alt, space, enter, that are often in like your pinky rows, are actually in thumb clusters, which takes relearning, but your thumbs are a lot faster and more, like you have more control over your thumbs than your pinkies. And so people kind of, they swear by like, yeah, you have to get used to this, but then once you're used to this, you like can't go back because it's so much more efficient to just use your thumbs, which makes sense. But also this keyboard is $460.
These ones are also weird because I don't know the actual reasoning behind it, but a lot of these split and ergonomic keyboards have this ortholinear layout where it's the every letter is just on the same grid versus keyboard. Any standard keyboard has staggered rows. You're used to like your fingers go at an angle, like, you know, diagonally to hit a different key. On these ones, they're all in like clean rows, which is also a bit of an adjustment.
Yeah, that would be confusing. I didn't really notice that. And that would be really, again, jarring. You'd have to get really used to that. You'd like, I feel like, especially going to the number row, you would be off by an entire key because they're no longer staggered in that way. Goofy.
Yeah. I mean, this has gotten me thinking about something that we've talked about before, but the Caracorder, which I just dropped a link in there, which I'm like, if I want to go for a high-end keyboard that is supposedly like super ergonomic, I'm like, do I just then spend a couple hundred more dollars and get
my favorite thing about this is like Mikhail, like this is targeted at people who have already decided to switch their keyboard layouts before, so they're not like worried about the concept. It's like, well, I've already switched keyboard, I've already switched away from QWERTY, so who the hell cares what I do now?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you can learn Dvorak, you can learn everything as a modifier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I learned Dvorak, decided that it wasn't for me, and then I learned Colmac.
Right. I forgot. I actually thought you were on Dvorak, but you're right. I'm wrong. You are even more out there than I thought. You are using not even the alternative layout everybody knows. You're using a different alternative layout.
Yeah, I'm using the different alternative layout, which is not included in Windows 10 by default.
Wow.
You have to go and download it, which is something that I had to actually do this weekend because... a story that I wasn't actually going to tell, but I'll just briefly say, my desktop just completely pooped the bed, as it were, and I had to just completely reinstall Windows from scratch. And this was one of the things that I forgot about, is that, it's just, Colmac is not included in Windows 10. Anyway, I got it working. It's fine. I'm going to move us on. I saw the solar eclipse, which was great. It passed just over, like, it pretty much just went almost the full length of Lake Ontario, because it crossed the border into Canada at Niagara Falls. I actually had a couple of friends who went there to see it, and apparently it was absolutely insane. There were so many people there.
I was going to say, that sounds chaotic.
Yeah, they said they handled it pretty well, though, because there is a commuter train line that goes down there, and on any regular schedule, like, it's a seasonal train, so it only regularly runs between May and September, and then also it usually only does four round trips per day from between Niagara and Toronto. But apparently they had, you know, done some good planning and had a bunch of extra trains out of season and, you know, on a more frequent basis timed for the eclipse. So apparently it was fine. There's plenty of space on each of the trains. So that one pretty well, but like the actual falls themselves were apparently super crowded. But I didn't go there. Went to Kingston, which is a city on the kind of east end of the lake. And man, have either of you seen a solar eclipse?
Not a total one.
Okay. Man. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's hard to communicate to somebody just how ridiculous it is to see this, because yeah, you can see photos and all that, but like until you're there and it just happens, you're like, oh, the sky just broke. Like it, yeah. This is my second one, and still like seeing it the second time, it was still just absolutely flabbergasting to just see that. And I understand all of the stories from history before people understood what was going on. I'm just being like, oh, the world is ending. I can totally right. see that.
Yeah, that's awesome that you're able to make that work.
Yeah, I was super lucky because there is a train line which goes there. So like we didn't even have to rent a car or anything like that.
Yeah, I would have considered, Sarah and I had talked about trying to get somewhere where we could see it. The closest place to here would have been like Indianapolis or like somewhere in Indiana.
Yeah.
But then we were at a wedding in Orange County, California. So it would have turned it into like this marathon trip where we like at the end of this trip to California, we would have then had to like fly instead of home to like somewhere where we could see it. Like we wouldn't have had time to like fly home and then drive. Like it just was a whole thing.
Mm.
We're like, we're not doing this just to see the eclipse. Because as much as it's a once in a lifetime, I feel like I've heard that before in my lifetime about eclipses. And Mikhail just said he's seen two of them. So
I mean, I will
feeling
say
good
that
about my odds.
I will say the two total solar eclipses that happened like this year and then 7 years ago when I saw it first, that doesn't happen very often. It just so it lined up that, you know, these two eclipses were both crossing North America instead of somewhere in the ocean.
Right.
But there is another one that is going through Spain in 2026. And then after that, like I think
2045 or something like that. I think
2045, I think, is the next one in North America, but it's like only going through northern Alberta mostly. I don't know. There will be other ones, but I think that was like the most convenient one to see if you don't want to have to leave North America for it in the near future.
That makes sense.
Anyway, all I'm saying is like, hey, if you get the chance to make a trip to go see a solar eclipse, I'd say do it. I certainly will.
Now I'm imagining how terrifying it would be to see a solar eclipse in the middle of the ocean, because you said that's like where most of them are. Like you would just feel so unsafe. You'd be like, where is Cthulhu?
Yeah.
Anyway, should we get started on this?
I was going to say, all you loyal listeners are looking at your podcast player and saying, huh, we're half an hour in. Was any of that corner case in order? Officially, no.
Amazing. I was going to say, this might be a record for latest start of Corner Case Corner in an episode.
Oh, no doubt. Other than ones where we've just skipped it to do like a text adventure.
Right. Right.
Okay. My first one's pretty quick. I, last year, got an amplifier for my guitar. It's a purely digital amp made by a company called Spark that kind of specializes in the digital music space. And by digital, I just mean like it's not a solid, or, you know, it's not like a proper amplifier that has inbuilt effects, not mine at least. It is everything about it is digital in terms of the effects. And so the way that it works is that you connect your phone to it, and on your phone you use the app made by this company, and you can dial in different effects. You can download effects that people have created themselves, but what it is a like it's a fake signal chain of pedals and an amplifier, and you choose which pedals and which amplifiers you want the app to be modeling for you, and then you adjust the dials and stuff as if it were a real signal chain. But the thing is, so I put a screenshot at the bottom of this document, right? And so, and that's an example of what the amplifier would look like. It looks like an amplifier, but just like, you know, a digital rendering of it. And so the question is, you look at these things, everything in guitar, basically everything in like digital audio, really, especially every guitar interface that I've seen, the vast majority of things are dials. They are things that you have to turn.
Yeah.
And that is not that compatible with most touchscreen ways of, like, how do you tell it, I'm going to, like, start here and turn it to here? It's not obvious. Luckily, I have a friend out here who also, after I got this amp, he got a different version of it, but, you know, he got another amp by this company, uses the same app for it and stuff, and he figured it out much faster than I did and told me, which is what you have to do is, like, put your finger on top of the dial and then just go vertically up or down. So pretend it's a slider.
Oh, my.
But as you're treating it like a slider, it pops up the number and tells you what value you're at, and, like, the dial moves rotationally as you're sliding up and down. So,
oh, boy.
Like, I understand why. You just feel like there should be any way to figure that out naturally. Because I had been sitting there for a month or whatever trying to spin these things on the screen, essentially, and not being able to figure out how the heck do I, like, it was just, the numbers were jumping around crazy. I just couldn't figure it out. So, yeah, just weird app interface. Once you understand it, it works perfect, but just trying to discover something like that is difficult. And there's no, like, because when I edit podcasts, the app that I use for that, like, there are also dial-y looking things, but if you don't want to fuss with that, you can, like, double tap on it and then just type in a number. There's no setting on that here. Like, I couldn't, like, double tap on something and be like, yeah, let's dial this in at a 6 or whatever. It's tough.
This is why companies like mine pay an entire team of UI and UX designers, so that this stuff is obvious, instead of, like, why mm-hmm. the hell is this not doing what I think it's doing? Why isn't it doing what I think it should be doing?
Yeah, and to be fair, Spark, like, this is not their, like, most... this is, like, their most recent thing. Mm-hmm. They are in the pro audio scene. Like, there are bands that use their, like, actual proper computer software to run the full signal chains for, like, full shows, full of amps and all this sort of stuff. Like, have high quality desktop software that you can use as well. It's just that, like, the point here is that it's convenient to have an amp. And also, my amp is, like, it's a 10 watt amp that runs off a battery. You never need it's USB-C rechargeable. So, like, the convenience factor is super high, and that's why the app exists. So I'm sure their, like, desktop software is, like, consistent with sort of industry ways of doing things. And then they just didn't really properly create either the interface or the onboarding for the interface on the app itself. What can you do?
When I was looking at this and you mentioned that, you know, the trouble was with the dials, I immediately thought, why not just make them sliders?
Yeah.
Because I know that amps don't generally have sliders, but there's plenty of audio equipment that uses sliders, and you can...
Because this is the thing. They have as far as I understand, they have official deals to kind of officially... It's similar to how if you get a digital keyboard, like a piano, they tell you, like, the default sound or the different sounds are modeling this exact model of piano.
Yeah.
And they have to have a deal for that. Like, it's not something that you could just do for funsies. I assume that, like, they have to actually, like, you know, work with a company to do it. Like, Casio doesn't make real piano, so whatever they're modeling, they have to work out a deal for it, I assume.
Sure.
The same thing goes here. Like, these are real amps made by real companies, and I bet those, just for the sake of, like, making it look consistent, they want it to look like it's the amp.
No, I get that, but I would hope that if you're a musician, the thing that you care about is the sound, and so yes, that would be modeling, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to recreate. But, you know, it seems like it would not be a difficult sell to tell people, is like, hey, this is a touchscreen, can we just make it a slider instead of a dial so that it's easier to use, and it'll still sound exactly the same?
Or even, like, if you, when you start touching the dial at all, like, a little slider superimposes on top of it, just so you know what you're about to do. It doesn't need to, like, show up there all the time, but yeah, it is the, like, you literally can't tell that it's supposed to be a slider until you figure out that moving my hand up and down does the thing that I want it to do.
Yeah. Oh, UI design.
I shouldn't be doing it, but someone should. That's my stance.
All right. So next thing, guys, I ran out of numbers.
Well, somebody had to. Yeah. It had to happen sometime.
He's a finitist.
Yeah, so basically, if you open up the link here, and then at the bottom of like the first post by MRJBQ7, anyway, way back in 2013, the bottom line there, it says, reason, error, I, format requires negative 2,147,483,684 is less than or equal to number, and then the positive version of that. So I encountered this error not at all in the same circumstance that this person got it, but turns out that the solution was the same. But basically what I was trying to do is I was trying to run a clustering algorithm on a set of data, but the thing is the clustering algorithm requires an input number, and I didn't know what input number would be the best. So I was trying to do a bunch of runs with different input numbers and see, you know, which one came out the best. What I tried to do is I was like, okay, this is all using the same data. I just need to run it in with different numbers. So I'll do the thing that the people at the supercomputer keep telling me to do, which is write it in parallel. So I was trying to just run this in parallel and have it just each do a different thing. And so what I thought was happening is that I was just running out of memory because I was trying to just do this too many times. And then I found out quickly that that was not the issue, because then if I tried just running one of them, I would still have the same problem. So instead of running a bunch in parallel, if I just ran one, same problem. And then eventually I talked to the help desk, who was able to dredge up this post from, oh geez, yeah, this is 11 years ago.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Okay, so then apparently the solution to this was actually a solution that I don't think it, maybe if I scroll all the way down, but it wouldn't have existed at the time of this post. But the solution is I just needed to use Python 3.8 or newer, and I happened to be using Python 3.7.
What an unsatisfactory explanation.
Yep. No, it's just like, it was just an error in the version of Python, like all the versions of Python before 3.8.
I will say, though, this is not really related, but looking at this, the response time from this initial post to the first response is 8 minutes.
I know.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, but I think, Jack, from your note there, yeah, I think it's absolutely something to do with, like the way that the numbers are stored.
Yeah.
Because it's very suspicious that it comes out to 2 to the 31. So it's obviously just the way that it's storing the signed integer in 32 bytes.
Yeah, right. Or 32 bits.
Bits. Probably bits. I think bits.
With a sign bit, like a leading sign bit or something. It's interesting. Yeah, for everybody listening at home, 2,147,483,648 is 2 to the 31st. So remember that. Put it on a flashcard or something. There will be a quiz. It
might show up in trivia next week.
There will be a quiz.
It might be. Anyway, I'm glad that it was. I was able to resolve it.
But
that didn't end the issues, but I won't go into those because I'm still dealing with them. I'll let you know if I'm able to figure it out.
Perfect. Cool. So I switched away from Arc Browser, which I'd been using for a while. It was the new kid on the block in the browser landscape. It's a fun browser. I believe I talked about it before on the show. Mm-hmm. But due to both the path that the company was taking in terms of the choices they were starting to make for default features to include and all this sort of stuff that just didn't really vibe with what I cared about, they also they had made a fundamental change to how the browser works, and then 3 or 4 months later rolled it back to how it initially worked.
Oh,
which just broke everything about how I operate with it. So there's that. And then also the fact that it's a brand new browser. It's Chrome based. The resource consumption on my laptop when I'm out and about was noticeable. So I decided to move away from it and went to Firefox. The main reason I went to Firefox is because it's the one browser that is super customizable, and I could create vertical tabs, which is how Arc worked. And I got so used to vertical tabs in Arc and how it allows me to have space on a web page and like keep tabs organized. Like, it just feels like I can have so many more tabs open and then organize them when they're vertical, that it just works so well for my brain. And Firefox lets you do that. It's trickier to do it in Firefox. So you do something like get an extension. I use tree style tab, which lets you create hierarchies of tab. So right now, if every time I click on a link in this Google Doc, it opens up as a tab that is the hierarchy is beneath the current tab. So I'll just like, the show notes tab. So let me just like take a quick little screenshot of like what my, the side tab looks like here. So that's what it looks like right now on my sidebar in Firefox. So I was in the Google Drive for the show notes. When I opened up the actual show notes, it goes as a sub tab. And then I've opened up two links currently from the show notes. Those are sub tabs.
I need this.
So that's great. The other thing that was a killer feature for Arc that Safari and Chrome both implement in okay ways is profiles, because I have three separate like Google entities that I use, and I really don't want them to mix because it just messes with things. For a long time, when I just use Chrome or Safari, I had memorized the order in which I had logged in to different Google accounts so that I knew how to change the URL to go to the correct user. So, because every Google URL, if you have multiple Google accounts logged in, it'll say like, you know, something like auth user equals two or slash u slash two, something like that in the URL that tells you go to the, in this case, it's zero index. So go to the third logged in account in the order in which they've been logged in. So I would do that for, I did that for years because there was no way to have different profiles. Arc had a really clean, like every profile has different bookmarks, different settings, like, and you could just like, it was literally a click or a keyboard shortcut to switch between any of those profiles at any point. Firefox is not that good, but you can have containerized tabs. So if I do, what is it? Control Command 1, that opens up a different tab. That is, here, I'll take another screenshot here. Okay, so the bottom tab that I just made, you'll notice has a little blue marker on it. That is my work profile. That's my work container. So when I open up any tab in that work container, it knows that the current account that I'm logged into on these other tabs is my personal Google account. That work container, the only thing I'm logged into is my work Google account. So any Google thing I go to, google.calendar.com or whatever, by default is going to be my work one. And then I have a third one for my, or a second, you know, specific container for a different Google account for like my contract work I do on the side. Now it doesn't have different like bookmarks or whatever, but that's easy because you can just make different bookmarks folders for different things and all that sort of stuff. And what I do at the beginning of each day is I can like right click on a bookmark folder and just say, open up all of these in my work container. And then I can select all of those tabs and say, okay, pin them to the top, because you can also pin tabs in tree style tab. So if I pin all of the tabs that I've opened so far, give you the sense of what a pin tab looks like. So there's one more. All those pin tabs show up as just the little icons up top.
Okay. So when you pin tabs and you click on those, does it just bring you to that tab, or does it also change the layout below?
So if I click on a pin tab, it just takes me to that tab.
Oh, okay.
There's nothing below. But then if I open up new tabs from a pin tab, that's where it says like tabs from episode 56 show notes, right? If I open up more links from the show notes document, they'll get thrown under that hierarchy telling me, hey, they came from this pin tab. And then you can switch between pin tabs with keyboard shortcuts, like Command 1 brings you to the first pin tab. So All this to be said, I've been extremely happy with Firefox. It's not perfect. Now, like, not every cool feature that Arc had, because they did a lot of cool stuff. I will give them a lot of credit in terms of, like, working with, like, pulling out video feeds. Like, you could, like, picture in picture any video feed and just, like, move it somewhere. Like, even if you were on, like, a meeting. Like, if I'm on Google Meet, I could picture in picture the entire Google Meet. And then, like, if I'm just on my laptop screen, that makes it easy to actually still see what people are doing, but then I can go to a different tab and do whatever else I need to be doing instead of trying to, like, split screen weirdly or have all these different browser windows open on just my laptop screen. So Firefox doesn't have all that stuff, but it's been really fun exploring what it does have, because it does have a lot built in. Yeah. And then you add in the extensions that people have built, like Tree Style Tab. And
yeah, no, I'm definitely going to be trying this out, because my solution to right now is on my work profile, I just have a bunch of different windows that all have different groups of tabs in them, which can, in some ways, is nice, because then I can visually see all of them at all times. I just need to, you know, use spaces to flip between the different windows. But I think this will help, especially for some where I have so many tabs that I keep open for certain things where I can't see all of them. And so I think this might be nice, because it looks like if it opens up vertically, then I'll be able to see a lot more tabs as opposed to just having them all strung out horizontally.
Yep, and then they just squish so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only thing I'll warn you about, which if you do play with this, I'll give you my info. Tree Style Tab, all it does is enable the vertical tabs. By default, horizontal tabs are also there.
Oh.
So again, Firefox is, in its beautiful way, its own little Linux-y kind of app, you know? Like, it has that vibe to it. So you do need to go into, like, the custom preferences and create, like, a... Like, there are versions that you can just find online, and I can just copy the one that I found that works seems to work really well on macOS. But you do have to, like, tell it, use this custom CSS profile that, like, adjusts the fact, like, it gets rid of the horizontal tabs. You also have to move, like, the various back button and refresh button. Those have to move to be out of the way of the, you know, window buttons, like the actual, like, close, minimize, maximize buttons. Like, it's little things like that, but people have made lots of these, and I just found one that was simple and clean and seems to work.
All right.
And then in the sub corner of Mark Finds Something Cool on the internet, I discovered this app called Play Ball. That's a terminal app. And it's just written in JavaScript, so you use NPM, which is like the JavaScript package manager, to install it. And once you have kind of added it to your path and done all that stuff correctly, you can just run Play Ball.
Wow.
And I don't know how it's pulling the data, to be honest. I literally have no clue if there's like an API that it's using via MLB, or if it's scraping pages. It's got to be some sort of data API. But it just it lets you navigate the schedule of the MLB season. By default, it looks at today. You can favorite certain teams, and then you can click into or select any game and just have the play-by-play of that game open. So it'll tell you what the current pitches have been and the current at-bat. It tells you the whole summary of every play that has occurred. It gives you the box score. It has a cute little icons for runners on base and balls and strikes and stuff. So I've had it running this whole time we've been recording, because the Twins are playing right now.
Oh, nice.
And it's like, it's just so small and sleek. You don't need to, like, because the MLB website, it's awesome. They've done so much cool stuff, but because there's so much stuff and there's so much animation and stuff, it's so slow. It's really clunky. It updates slowly. It's just a resource hog of a website. So something that gets me 75% of what I care about.
Yeah.
This is fascinating.
In a terminal app like this is just fun.
I'm so curious. I was thinking that it wouldn't take me that many guesses to figure out how they're getting the data.
Yeah, I poked through it very briefly, but like, I don't know JavaScript. That's part of it. I'm also not good at actually, like, you know, I've never built software. I've written plenty of scripts.
Right.
I've never packaged software in a way that is appropriate. So I don't even know where to begin to, like I can go to the SRC folder because I know that that's where it's going to be. But, like, you know,
And they're using React, like they're using a framework, so that also makes it confusing because you know that there's certain things that a React developer would look at and be like, well, obviously that means that this is here. And I'm like, I have no idea what this is even doing. I'm shocked that they're using something like React for something that displays in the terminal. Like, this is just mind-blowing to me. This is so interesting.
Yeah.
What a cool thing to find. Because the display is like so, like when you said like watch from the terminal, I was like, oh, this is going to be kind of a meme. Like, I didn't know what to expect. And then you look at like, it's such a robust display. Like, yep. It's amazing.
And it has your Vim key bindings by default for navigating. Yes. Like, everything is like a click away where it's like, I'm currently on the game, but I can just hit one letter on my keyboard to go to a different view very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it is like, it's amazingly thoughtfully designed for something that is mm-hmm. so beautifully niche. And I just love it.
Take that. Engineers do watch sports.
Actually, that's a funny aside. Our trivia team, like, it's me and then a bunch of grad students who are all studying, you know, biophysics or bioinformatics and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've become like the jock team at our trivia night because we're the team that often gets the sports questions correct. It just so happens.
Yeah, this is written in 100% JavaScript, according to GitHub.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's how you can pull it from NPM because it's just like it's basically its own JavaScript module.
That is so sick. I'm a fake programmer. I've never written actual software. People have asked me that before. They're like, oh, have you ever like, because you know how to code, have you written software? I'm like, no.
I have, I think, two things on my personal GitHub that contain like a proper folder structure where like I've written functions that are then referenced somewhere else in like a main script. I think I've done that twice ever. And right. Every single time I have to look up even how to do something that simple, let alone like a real thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. it's so funny because I feel like there's like a trope within programming. And this kind of feeds into like the main topic, what we were going to talk about today. But like, I feel like there's this trope in programming about like one of the first things people do is like build a website in HTML or something. And like, yeah, that's all well and good. But like, I think most of the things that I've done in my programming career pale in comparison to like your average website today. Your average website today is it's so complex and they're using like 4 different languages and they're using these frameworks that are like supposed to improve developer experience and like they're unreadable. Like, I don't understand what's happening in them at all. I don't understand React. I don't understand JavaScript. I think I understand CSS until I look at real production CSS and then I'm like, oh, I have no idea what this is doing. This is just magic. I have no idea what this says.
Yeah. Well, is building software something that you're going to add to this discussion here? Or I guess I'm just trying to prompt you to, you know, I think this is a good segue.
Speaking of prompt, Mark prompted us for ideas for this episode. And I thought, well, we all engage with programming. And I am in the very early stages, relatively early stages of moving into a new role at work that's more technical. The role is like what's called a sales engineer, which kind of feels funny because that was my title at my first job out of school. But it was a very different job. And it's just totally different. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. But I've come full circle, guys. Started at the bottom. Now we're back at the bottom. the sales engineer role for people listening at home is essentially the idea that I'm working at a company that's selling software. Let's say Mark's company is evaluating my company's software. Their primary point of contact at my company would be like a full cycle salesperson who's really like their business counterpoint, who understands the software very well, but is not necessarily a technical person. Their level of technical knowledge varies depending on what you're talking about. And then they have a technical counterpart who does a little bit of the deeper solutioning ahead of any sort of actual commercial agreement. So that's like pre-sales solutioning, helping to figure out if we can actually solve the problems they're looking to solve, answer technical questions, all that stuff. So that's the role that I am exploring moving into, which requires putting my programmer hat back on, figuring out how to do this again. And so I thought it'd be interesting, now that this has been top of mind for me, for us all to talk about just generally, we can take this in a million different directions, but just to think about like how each of us engages with coding and programming day to day, both like professionally and personally, and then just, yeah, how we set up our technical environment, how we think about our engagement with this kind of material now and into the future, like if we have any personal or professional goals to like become more technical. Like, I feel like we've all studied very technical things or are studying very technical things, but then have all taken different paths in terms of what we do now. So yeah, I just thought this would be an interesting topic at a high level. And then, like I said, we can take it in whatever direction we really want to, whatever's interesting.
Well, I have a question which is going to immediately throw us into like a philosophical state, but I do want to bring it back to the practicalities later. Is something I was wondering, do you guys make a significant distinction between coding and programming?
I don't between those two terms. I think there are other terms where I would quibble, mm-hmm. but for me, like, I guess if I were forced to make a distinction, I would say that programming is like the slightly higher level version of it. Not necessarily in like ability or whatever, but coding would literally be the act of typing code or doing whatever, you know, making the code a reality versus the programming could be considered the hierarchically just above it. So programming would likely contain coding within it for practical purposes, mm-hmm. but the programming could also be part of the design work. But then that doesn't necessarily fully involve all of that, because you can go higher than what most people would consider programming. Because when you talk about people who are like full-blown computer scientists or whatever, developing an algorithm and stuff like that, like that's another step above that. Mm-hmm. Where someone who's like programming is likely using existing tools and mishmashing them together. And then the coding is like the implementation of the program, I guess. But for casual conversation, when I think about it, like the people I interact with at my job,
fair enough.
It's like, well, they kind of do both. So I just think of it as one, really.
I associate the term programming with high level in terms of skill, but low level in terms of level of abstraction. Like when I think of somebody being a computer programmer, as opposed to say a developer in the modern sense of the word, I think it's all about the level of abstraction that you're working at. And again, this is kind of like semantic and like theoretical, but I think it is interesting, like conversation. Like I just listened to, I think I listened to it previously, but I re-listened to an interview with like a long form interview that Lex Fridman did of John Carmack, who is, people argue whether or not John Carmack is like one of the best. It's hard to say best of any topic ever, but people argue that he's one of the most competent computer programmers of all time. And the reason people say that is that he and his team drove the early development of video games. And in order to do so, they had to really push the limits of existing hardware, requiring them to...
Is this Doom guy or is this someone else?
This is the Doom guy. Yeah. Yeah. And so, for instance, like in this interview, he gave examples of like, oh, well, we were writing these basic games in assembly. I want that on the record too. He was writing games in assembly, and that they were restricted by the refresh rate of the computer, but there were workarounds where if you overflowed the buffer containing like the, like say, I mean, you're programming onto a screen, right? You're like displaying onto a screen. So it's essentially a grid of pixels, especially at that time. It's like a grid of pixels that are RGB. He said that like, well, yeah, if you actually overflowed this buffer, it would just cycle like the previous, like it would cycle like the last row to the first row just by default. That was like the default hardware behavior. So they took advantage of that. And if they had the background of a screen be simple and consistent, which people wouldn't really notice or care about because video games were pretty nascent at the time, they could squeeze better performance out of the game by just taking advantage of this like hardware behavior that they basically just discovered almost experimentally. And when I think of stuff like that, I'm like, that is down at the bare bones programming, as opposed to what most people are doing that is still like requires problem solving and all of that. But when people are working in these really highly abstracted frameworks for, say, web development or something, not that there's anything bad about web development, it just is a very different task. They're like very different kinds of people. And I feel like if I were to differentiate between those terms, I think colloquially and just like talking to people that you meet day to day, they're all the same thing. But there is a fundamental difference in where you operate at level of abstraction. That they're like, and like with anything, there are great and mediocre engineers at every level of abstraction. There are people who are amazing at using these like high leverage, highly abstracted tools to quickly develop really robust solutions. Then there are also people who operate at this really low level of abstraction and are just moving bits around, but they deeply understand the hardware they're working on and they can like squeeze more water out of the rock in a sense. And that's where I associate, yeah, that's where I associate the term like programmer or like a true like engineer in a sense is the people mm-hmm. who are doing that kind of work. But again, this is like semantic and it's not intended. It's hard to have this conversation without sounding like you're disparaging people who operate at like, there's like, obviously these frameworks exist for a reason that like makes day-to-day development of products far more practical. And you don't always have to have the most amazing, and even John Carmack said this in the interview, like you don't always have to have like the most amazing refresh rate and performance on like a web application or a website. Like you just don't need that. There's like no reason to spend mm-hmm. those resources and like pay a really competent assembly engineer to like make your JavaScript run faster or like make your website refresh faster. It just doesn't make sense.
I do want to say that I encountered a reference to John Carmack recently on, there's an episode of the Podcast of Unnecessary Detail, which is by the Festival of the Spoken Nerd, which includes Matt Parker, the stand-up mathematician. Mm. And apparently, like, the... I forget exactly what the detail was, but there was some error in the trigonometric functions in the original Doom that really didn't change anything, but somebody found it, and then apparently like the original code for Doom is just on GitHub, and somebody made a pull request to fix this, and John Carmack, like, you know, apparently came out and was like, oh hey, yeah, you found a bug, like, cool. Like, you know, this is something that we completely overlooked, thank you. I just thought that was very funny. It's like, it's such an old game and people are still like giving it updates.
Yeah. I mean, he talked about that in the podcast. And
I got to make sure it can run on my toaster.
Exactly. Exactly.
Uh-huh.
That was, I think, the most interesting part of, that was one of my favorite things about the fact that Lex was interviewing him, because Lex is like, the jury's still out on whether Lex Friedman is actually a human or if he's some sort of robot. And so he went like really into the weeds about like, what did you learn and like what challenges did you bump into as you like develop this like sequence of games, essentially like this period in which they like really pushed the bounds of what could be done on these machines. And it was really interesting hearing him talk about the way that they solved certain, like, because at the end of the day, a lot of what's happening in those games is like geometric, like transforms that you have to perform really quickly in the code. But then there are certain situations that can arise that will, like, as he described this issue where, like, if a monster was approaching you, the closer the monster was to you. So the monster, any given monster in the game is like there's like a template for this monster, right? And so if the monster is closer or farther from you, they have to be scaled a different amount. And they said they ran into this problem while they were developing it, that the closer the monster was to you, which is when you want to be able to react the fastest, when it's like right in your face, right? That scaling the monster up to be bigger would slow down the frame rate of the game. So like the closer the monster was to you, it would slow the game down. They're like, well, this is just unacceptable. This is like, we might as well not even ship this game if this is going to be the case. We have to fix this. And so it was interesting hearing him talk through, like, again, like the deep math required to solve these problems and get things to work properly. And you're right, like the corners that they essentially cut, Mikhail. He talked about that explicitly, that like there were certain things. I mean, somewhat infamously, John Carmack didn't write this code, but there's like this somewhat infamous idea of like the inverse square root function. That's like, you can find entire like 30-minute videos explaining it on YouTube. Just like this insane function in the open source for Quake, where they had to calculate inverse square roots really efficiently for these transforms. They had to like, or these transformations, they had to do this all the time. And so somebody wrote this, like, you read it through from top to bottom once and you're like, I don't understand how is this calculating an inverse square root? It never does it. But they were just using like tricks of like float bytes and like binary. Like it's incomprehensible when you read it, but then you hear somebody explain it, you're like, okay, I guess I understand sort of what this is doing. But like the guy who, like, I've heard people talk about that too, it's like, I feel like I'm a good programmer, but then I remember that somebody came up with the inverse square root algorithm, and then I'm like, I'm not a good programmer. That guy's a much better programmer than I am. I don't know, this is an interesting tangent, Mikhail. I appreciate this, because it is like, what does it really mean to do these things? Because people can like get up and running as developers for very narrow applications quite quickly without knowing any of this that we're talking about. Because the tools, which is amazing. It's like amazing that the environment, that the tools are so robust that somebody can like download VS Code and work for like a few months through these like online tutorials and like be semi-competent. They can do stuff for sure. They can build stuff that works.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting like thing to think about, is, you know, how quickly you can become competent in certain areas But then, you know, just realizing the absolute depths that you can become competent is unending.
Yeah, and that's like a somewhat, I don't know if controversial, but like disputed idea within programming, I know, is that people talk a lot about how one of the best things about that as like a career path, a full-blown career path, is that it doesn't require, you can be self-taught. You can just like do tutorials online, read books, and learn this all yourself. But one criticism of that I've heard is that if you learn exclusively from a high level of abstraction, then when things don't work, you don't have the foundation you necessarily need to like dig in and figure out what happened, as opposed to like I always think back to when I was in electrical engineering school and the first language they taught us was C. And I was like, why do you hate us? Why are you making us do this? But it does help because like now I know. Now I'll never forget what's happening under the hood. And like it's not top of mind all the time. But if something were to break, I could at least try to dig in and understand what's happening. And so there's like it's somewhat controversial. Like, can you go the reverse? Can you like start at a high level of abstraction and then over time learn the lower levels of abstraction? I'm sure people have, but it's like a disputed thing of like whether it's valuable to go to computer science school or like some sort of engineering school where you learn to code and they force you to do these lower level things that most people would not pursue of their own accord. They kind of have to be made to appreciate what happens at that level of abstraction and like memory allocation and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think the level of abstraction debate is a super important one. At least my opinion is that I think of it kind of like, you know, learning about cars. You could make that analogy where, in my opinion, you should probably learn how to drive a car before you learn how to repair one. And obviously, you know, there are different situations where you might have, you know, different things happen in different orders. But for me, I feel like, you know, especially with programming, at least, you know, I'm biased. This is how I learned, is that I figured out, you know, I had programming do things that I thought were interesting and fun. And then I went back and figured out how it all worked, so that I had the interest and the motivation to stick through learning assembly and C and stuff like that, and Fortran even, realize it's like, okay, this is why we have this abstraction to something like Python at that certain level.
And I think so much of this is also a matter of, like, what about it is valued?
Mm-hmm.
The reason that like people are successful in various programming roles without having, even if maybe they took like one random class that told them assembly's kind of like this, and then they're like, whatever. And then they like that tickled your guys' minds. I bet there are a lot of other people in those classes who like took it because they had to, and they don't care. And they're still extremely successful,
right,
not caring about that low level because the skill set that they have that is valued is not that part of it. Like for me, I'm no exceptional coder or programmer or whatever, but like I've written code, I write code at work, I write code for fun. I've never looked into assembly. I don't know how C works. I've heard Jack explain it to me randomly in college at various points when he was learning about it, but I don't think that really counts. Just like anything, you know, like for me, I think a lot of the times the best way to learn stuff is like circular in terms of you learn certain high levels of abstraction, you dive deeper, you rinse and repeat. It's like it's the same thing of like thinking about learning physics. Like a lot of physics is like you learn the best case scenario, and then the next year you learn why that was all a lie, and then you sort of rinse and repeat that for a little while.
Uh-huh.
Programming could be taught bottom up, it could be taught top down. In reality, a lot of it is a mix. It's like, okay, you learned about assembly and you probably learned maybe some bits about like hardware design as a result of that, but realistically it's not like you learned precisely how. I mean, you're, I guess, electrical engineering probably, but let's take a computer science major as a different example of like they can still be successful, but how deep do you want to go, right? Like that's always the question, right? And there's a practical limit to, well, what's like the deep part of it? That's always the question, and at some point you have to kind of set a limit on it and just say this is the level at which we care. If you want to go deeper, you can, but you don't. 99.9% of the time, it's not going to matter. And if that 0.01% happens, there's probably going to be someone else who can help you.
Yeah.
It's not going to be your fault or your job to necessarily deal with that exact issue.
Yeah, and there is a trade-off to that lower level knowledge that I will even like agree with Mark, and like, not that we're disagreeing, we're all just having a discussion, but like part of the trade-off to that that I've complained about since college is like, yeah, I spent all this time like learning C and assembly and like working on microcontrollers and stuff. And some of that's my fault for picking the major that I did, separate topic. But spent all this time doing this stuff. And then I got out into the world, and then I was exposed to actually using Excel to solve problems as opposed to just like making a very basic spreadsheet, like programming VBA in Excel, like that whole world. And then also SQL, structured query language for interacting with databases. And I was like, wow, this is profoundly powerful. I've never heard of any of this. And now I have to learn it all from scratch, which is good. I'm happy to learn it now, better now than never. But it's like, wait, why was like, it's all a trade-off, right? And so if you spend all this time working on low-level stuff and you never learn any higher level, like higher levels of abstraction that allow you to work more quickly and efficiently. And again, they're abstracting away things that are probably irrelevant, especially in the age of like, we're also in this, comparing to John Carmack, like John Carmack was operating in a world where like you had to be concerned about like, well, like, oh, we like our customers have these computers that have like so little memory that it's like hard for us to even imagine at this point with like what's on our computers. And now we live in a world where every like software developer at a large company basically just has unlimited cloud space and unlimited power. They can do whatever they want. Like they really don't even have to care about performance. Like it's pretty irrelevant because they just have like, well, we'll just spend more on AWS. And like, you care about performance to an extent, and like I see all the time at my company, like we could in a sense not, I don't know, you care about performance at a certain point. Depending on what you're working on, performance matters and you have to care about that stuff. But for the most part, it's not as relevant today as it once was, which again, like with anything, it comes with pros and cons. Like if you're not forced to care about that stuff, then if it suddenly becomes important, those muscles are pretty weak and you're going to have to figure out how to write things that run efficiently. But for a lot of people, you don't really have to worry about that. And we live in a world of specialization, and it's important that there are people who are happy working at this high level of abstraction, working on like design and making things look really great using like React and I don't know, CSS and stuff like that. And they're like, this looks great, doesn't it? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You don't have to write assembly. If you tried to write the web, if you got a front end developer job and then you told them you were going to write everything in assembly, they would maybe just fire you on the spot. I'm not sure. They'd probably talk to you first and be like, was that a joke? Is this a meme? Is this something I just don't understand from you Zoomers or something? But then they'd be very concerned. Mm-hmm. They're like, you are never going to accomplish anything unless you type really fast, I guess. But even then, it's going to be tough to imagine.
Hey, man, give me a camcorder and I'll give it a try.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. Should we dive into the move from the philosophical to the specific?
Sure.
Plant our own flags on the ground.
Yeah, it's getting a big fight. Now that we got away with... Now that we got past the stuff where we all agree.
Not quite what I was saying, but...
No, this is it's one of those things that it's funny because it's some of these topics are things that people do like really argue about, and the fact that they do, I just find really funny. Like the idea that anybody cares what programming environment anybody else uses or what their favorite like language to write a script in is, the fact that anybody cares about that is very funny. But everybody has their preferences. So I'm really curious to hear. Like I know for instance that Mikhail writes a lot of code, and I learned from earlier this episode that some of it's Python, so that's curious. But I really don't know like what environment you work in and what you do, frankly.
Yeah, well, I did want to say, like, I think I agree with your sentiment, but not necessarily the words that you used, because I do think that, I do agree that if people are expressing opinions on which is the best and, you know, are aghast that people are using something that they don't use, I find that really annoying and kind of and frustrating. But I do think it is really interesting to me to hear about what people use, especially if it's different from me, and especially if it's really similar to me. I think it's where I get, you know, kind of bored is when it's like slightly different, but not enough to be like completely out of my like scope of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So I will, you know, I'm just going to jump into mine is like, you know, for all of my programming, pretty much all of my programming that I do is professional. because I just do not have the time to do stuff for myself right now. I do want to do more programming for fun, because I used to do that and it was great. But yeah, for work stuff, I am pretty much entirely coding just in Python, and sometimes I will write a bash script. So that's in the born again shell. As much as macOS wants me to switch the Z shell, I refuse. A lot of what I'm doing is, I would, you know, to go back to the question I asked, like, a lot of what I'm doing, I consider it to be coding, because I am just writing code to make a thing do the stuff, to make a plot and, you know, analyze the data. And I think a lot of the programming that I did in my degree happened earlier when I was planning out in this research project what I was actually going to do. And I guess that's kind of what I consider the difference to be, where, yeah, I think, Mark, you described it as sort of like, you know, an umbrella term that programming is. And I think that's how I think about it in a lot of ways, where programming includes coding, which is typing out all of this stuff. But I think it also includes the sort of like pseudocode idea, which, you know, is something that is so hard to impress upon students how important it is to write pseudocode, which is just write out like just a not in a programming language, just in actual words, what do you want your program to do? Because it's a weird thing to try to, you know, realize that in the process of taking what you think in your brain and processing that and getting it into code that a computer can understand, having that intermediate step of writing it out as pseudocode, I think, really helps. Yeah, so that's basically it. I just write in Python, and I'm basically just writing stuff to manipulate data in some way and then make a plot of it. That's pretty much all that my programming does. The end point is a nice looking plot. So some of that is data manipulation, and an annoyingly large amount of it is me fighting with matplotlib to just make something actually look reasonable.
I hate matplotlib, but it's so important, but I hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's, I would consider myself similar to Mikhail, just the scale is certainly less. Like, it's not a huge part of my job. The reason it's a part of my job is because I happen to have the skills. So because I am comfortable using Python, a lot of the data that I pull is from a SQL database. So I'm not often writing SQL queries from scratch. I'm editing ones that already exist, and then I'm using Python to further refine the data and do what I want with it. The end result often being either a chart that's less common. There's really one thing that I can think of that I built that was, because a lot of the if it's for just me, it could just be whatever random Python scripts I want. Sometimes I build things that are useful for someone else that I work with, and then I'll put them in a Google Colab notebook, like a Jupyter notebook. Mm. So that way I can just be like, I can write out the instructions and just be like, hey, upload a file that's called this, and then hit the big play button, and then a different file is going to be spit out. Just because sometimes it's way easier to build something like that for me that I know will work each time than to need to throw something into a spreadsheet and do like 7 pivot tables until I get it refined to the way that I need it. But a lot of the output is just a different CSV that I then need to put into a spreadsheet for it to be accessible and usable by the actual people that I work with who need that information in a very like clear way that's quickly updated. So at work, that is like my most frequent flow. It's like I'm pulling data using SQL. If I need to mess with it using Python, I will. Sometimes I don't, and it goes straight into a spreadsheet, and I'm just messing around in a spreadsheet. And then every so often, I get to build something actually cool, like plotting all of our orders on a map of the United States. It's like I have a little flow now to do something like that.
Cool.
So yeah, that's typically what it is at work. I'm on the I haven't coded in a while for fun cycle of my year. I feel like there's kind of between 3 and 6 months total of each year where I'm suddenly like, I'm going to get back into technical stuff. and whatever that might be. It could be using more Python to analyze baseball data. Every year I've done some random coding project. Like several years ago, it was creating a really bad Python application that could add MP3 chapters before I had a tool to do that on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
I built a whole suite of mathematical functions once to help me with curriculum development for creating images of shapes, because we used an explicit coordinate, use explicit coordinates to create a pentagon. But sometimes the inbuilt functions are not as flexible as you want them to be to create this regular pentagon. Or if it's not a regular pentagon, now what do you do? And so I created a bunch of mathematical functions that I could use to kind of give it a small number of parameters and then spit out all of the coordinates that I would need to do something.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I need a triangle that has exactly these three side links. Please tell me where I need to put them on this grid so I don't need to do trig by hand every single time I need to make a triangle. I haven't done anything like that recently. It has been more like analyzing baseball data, using Python, SQL, stuff like that. But the one thing I do still want to do at some point, it's been on my list now for a while, but last year I got the Playdate, which I'm pretty sure I told you guys about, which is just a cute little handheld console. They have a bunch of really simple developer tools that you can build a game in the browser if you wanted to. It's on my list to take the time, take a week to really just dig in and explore that and just see if I can build something just silly and fun and simple, just because it sounds like it would be enjoyable, but I haven't taken the time yet. But nice. That's kind of where I'm at with programming and such.
I want it on the record that I find internal tools interesting, because you kind of contrasted it with actual interesting things. And I do think internal tools, maybe this is just my autism, but my specific flavor of autism, but I think internal tools that make somebody's life more efficient are very interesting. I think that's a great use of time to do, because that's basically all the programming that I do is mm-hmm. I mean, I've told you guys about random things that I've solved with code over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Because I have not spent a lot of time coding. I do not do any coding professionally. So any time that I spend coding is either just direct attempts at learning or keeping myself sharp, or being randomly faced with a coding problem or a problem that can be solved with coding in my day-to-day life and being like, even if this isn't the most efficient way to do this, I'm going to solve this with code because that's what I should do with my brain. And so I'll go and solve that, my communicating with the Google Calendar API to put stuff on my calendar, which was a giant pain in the butt. But again, another thing that I never learned to do in school that's so important for coding in the modern world is interacting with APIs. I barely knew what they were when I started at my current job. I vaguely knew what they were. I knew what it stood for, application programming interface, but I didn't really know anything about them. And now I have to learn a bunch about them, because that's what my company, at the end of the day, my company has a bunch of APIs and a dashboard environment for people to work in that is built on top of our APIs. And so I need to know how the APIs work. And I really, that's my short-term project, is to build a dummy application, an MVP application on my company's APIs. Because I know in doing so, I will probably have to learn a bunch, because it'll be really hard, because I don't know how it works. I know what our product does, or products do, and so I know that I can figure it out. I trust that I can figure it out. But yeah, in terms of professional programming, like I said, I don't really have anything going there. If I am going to solve a problem, my default is to solve that problem in Python. I write all my code in VS Code because it's handy. I do use the Vim extension to VS Code. That's my connection to using Vim. I'm a big believer in Vim for efficiency, but I'm not a believer in actually using NeoVim or something. I'm not a believer necessarily in using... I don't have enough experience to have a strong opinion, but I don't want to try to switch to using exclusively CLI Windows, terminal Windows, to do all of my programming. I think VS Code is very pretty. I think it's kind of neat. It's got little nice menus and extensions, and I like it. And I don't need to I don't need to step back in time and use exclusively NeoVim or one of those tools. But I think the Vim motions are just so powerful that it just makes sense to use those.
Yeah. You mentioned using VS Code, and I just wanted to give a shout out to something that I've been finding so useful over the past couple months. I use VS Codeium, which is basically just all of the code that is used to make VS Code, except without the wrapper that Microsoft put around it to have telemetry, which, you know, like, if you don't mind that, you know, whatever, man, doesn't matter to me. But the thing that I love about is, like you said, the extensions. And one of them that I figured out that I actually have access to, because I have a student status, is, well, I have access to for free, is the GitHub Copilot, which is, I don't know what sort of large language model it's based off of, but there's, it basically is an extension that you can implement. And then it requires a connection to the internet, but as you're typing, I think regularly in some of the default extensions that come with VS Code, it'll be able to kind of suggest autofills for you, which are mostly just if you start typing the name of a function or a variable that already exists, then you can hit tab and it'll just complete that. Basically what Copilot does is it will extend the sort of range of possibilities as to what you can tab complete. And so something that it does very well is if I want to, say, write a function in Python, if I first make a comment and I describe what the function is going to do, and then I hit enter and type def space, then I will see the option to tab complete in a fully fleshed out function with, you know, a function name and variable arguments and a comment thread showing you what all of the variables are supposed to be, and then sometimes a good amount of code, and then whatever it should return is already there. And most of the time, it's like probably 70-80% of the way to what I actually wanted. And so it's super convenient. I can just hit tab, complete that, change the things that are obviously not what I wanted it to be, and, you know, test it out. That works super well. Another thing that I found works super well is in my specific project, I'm dealing with 17 different years of data. And so often I will need to do something 17 different times, but with slightly different parameters. And so it's very good at recognizing the pattern. And so if I start typing, you know, like, hey, I want to do this for 2005, 2006, 2007, and it's like, oh, do you want to just do it for the rest of the years that you've mentioned in other parts of your code? I'm like, yes, thank you. And so it saves me a lot of time in that way, and actually really helped out when I was doing, actually, I forget if I mentioned this, I did a hackathon, which I guess is kind of, it was a weird mix between like kind of personal interest in coding and professional, because
I'm so happy you mentioned this, because my company just did a hackathon 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Was it just like a weekend thing, or did you participate?
So it was a hackathon in a looser sense, because it's not like we're strictly a software company. It was a mix of engineering and then other projects.
Oh, nice.
But we dedicated a whole week to it.
Sweet. Did you participate though?
I did. Okay. Not on the writing code side, because I'm not an engineer at my company, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But on the let's call it product development consulting kind of stuff.
Okay. Was it like an internal hackathon? Like it was just for employees?
Yes.
Or?
It was a company hackathon, because we are creating an R&D department.
Ah.
And the hackathon was sort of like the first effort by that department as it begins to become a thing, partially to just create a huge number of ideas for it to look into based on what people came up with, what the company's excited by. Yeah, it was fun.
Cool. Well, yeah, so I guess the one that I participated in is a bit different, because I think it was technically open to anybody from the public, but it was advertised at pretty much just on university campuses. So I think everybody that participated was either currently a student or like a recent graduate. And also, you know, it was very self-selecting, because it was themed as the Climate Impacts Hackathon. It was put on by my department, so, you know, I knew the professor who was running it is on my committee, and or one of the professors that was running it. But it was seems to be of the category of these sorts of hackathons, which are like competitions that you need to apply to. They're usually just a weekend, and then the winning team or teams have some sort of prize that they get. In this case, it was one weekend, so we started on a Friday afternoon and then worked, had some presentations that we watched, and there was a panel discussion about climate impacts kind of in general, and to kind of like set the scene for it. And then we were working until 10 p.m. And then on Saturday, we started at 9, worked till 10 p.m. Sunday, started work at 9, and then we had to present what our teams had ready at that point at noon. And so it was very, you know, not as chaotic as some of the stories people were telling me about other hackathons that they've been to, where they're saying, oh, they just like slept on the couches or in the lounge or just like, you know, even under the tables and just never really went to sleep sometimes. So it wasn't nearly that chaotic, but it was still very long days. But it was really interesting. I had a very quick crash course in this technique of dynamic downscaling for using climate or Earth system model output to make predictions on stuff. So, which was pretty cool because it's something that people in my department do all the time. And, you know, I've seen things that people do with this to say like, oh, how is the climate going to change into the future? But the issue with these is that all of the climate projections are done on a 1 degree by 1 degree grid, which, you know, if you don't know what that is, like, it's generally hundreds of kilometers by hundreds of kilometers. So not exactly useful if you're looking at local problems, since we are looking at a problem like at the level of the city of Toronto. And so there's this whole big technique that you can use to kind of make your best guess as to how you can, you know, get finer resolution on this using historical data. But this GitHub Copilot helped me so much because there was a lot of things that I didn't really know about. And so I'm not exactly sure like where it's pulling from, but it knew a lot of the sort of things that I was trying to type out ahead of time. Like, you know, I'm typing a function and it would suggest to me, it's like, oh, do you, like, I know what these variables are that you've already made. I think these should go into the arguments in this order or something like that. And most of the time it was dead on. So I just wanted to give that shout out. Oh, and I guess also I should mention, my team did win the hackathon. And so I'm supposed to be getting nice. $200 at some point.
Wow.
But that might take a while.
Nice. Good job.
Thanks.
My team got prizes too.
Oh, nice.
Pretty good.
Heck yeah.
I get a sweatshirt. I don't know where this leaves us. Jack.
I guess I was just generally talking about, like, you know, the environment that you use. And so I was just saying, like, this GitHub Copilot has really very quickly become something that I am making heavy usage of whenever I'm in the act of coding.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it. I've never tried it yet because, again, I'm kind of in the early stages of this shift, but I'm going to test it out maybe when I'm just going to test it out a little bit. I have my only hesitation with it is what you just said about how it was making these suggestions and it was almost always right, which is very scary. Almost always right is very scary. And so there's part of me that's like, yeah, this is awesome. And I am going to definitely look into using it and how I could best leverage it. But I also want to be very careful about how I use it, because I feel like it can introduce bugs. Like, for instance, I remember watching somebody showing that, I think they just asked Copilot to like write, like, they was like, all right, this function, just write the quicksort algorithm. It's either quicksort or merge sort, which is like, there's an answer to that. It's not like you're asking it to do anything ambiguous. There's a correct answer, and it got it wrong, but it looked really close, which is like worse almost. Like, you'd almost wish that it would just like give you like a shrug emoji and be like, sorry, I don't know. And then you could just go figure it out yourself. But instead it tries, and then it's like, here you go, boss. And then you have something wrong in your code. So I don't know. I think it's a really powerful tool, and it's only getting better. So that's where it's only going to continue to improve, and that's really cool. I don't remember what my company's policy is on Copilot. I think they were really hesitant at first, and now we have an enterprise license, so there's no data sharing. Because you don't want any proprietary code being shared with. I remember there was something that I heard at one point where like Amazon raised a stink, either internally or externally, I don't remember, because they started noticing that like Copilot's suggestions, it was either Copilot or just like ChatGPT, their code suggestions were almost straight out of like the AWS code base or something. And it was because engineers within Amazon were just using ChatGPT under their like personal account. They were just like submitting it code and be like, hey, can you like write unit tests for this? Or can you do whatever? And so ChatGPT like learned on their code and started making those suggestions. And they're like, this is proprietary. This is not like in a public repo or something. This is our proprietary code. But of course, ChatGPT doesn't know that. ChatGPT is just out here writing code. It's just trying its best. And so like that was something that I think early on scared our legal department. We have a lot of requirements around data compliance and privacy because a big chunk of what our company does is integrate to and interact with bank interfaces, whether those are like file transfer or APIs. And so the banks impose, rightly, a lot of security considerations on us.
Well, I think that is a very good point, and it's something that I just never really thought about because my like risk is so low for if I get something wrong. But I think something I want to clarify is that I am mostly using this to auto-complete things that I was already going to type.
Yes.
Which I think, you know, makes a big difference. I'm not using this like on a blank sheet, on a blank file of code and just saying, generate some stuff. I already have a huge code base and basically I'm just like, I need a new function which will do something very similar to a different function. And I, you know, start typing it out and it suggests like, hey, is this what you want? I'm like, you know, it's pretty close. I'm just going to tab complete, change a couple of things that I know, you know, I need to get correct and then just move on from there. But I think, yeah, if you are using this to just say like, hey, just completely generate from scratch something that does this, I think I would be very hesitant to use that without testing it pretty well.
Yeah, there's things you can do like the use cases for it in my mind are like things you're describing, like it's auto-completing for you. There's also I've heard that it will catch typos. Like before you run your code and figure out that you like named something wrong, it'll just like tell you like, hey, you just misspelled that variable. And you're like, oh, thanks. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. I don't know if that's Copilot. This was something that VS Codium already did for me before I installed Copilot, where it would highlight things, you know, just like in spell check kind of, or give me like little warnings.
Yeah. It's just the like language linter kind of stuff.
Yeah, but the use cases that I see for Copilot where it'd be like super useful is anything that would typically take you out of your coding environment to look something up can all now just happen locally. So you can just like briefly stop and be like, oh, like how do you do this in Matplotlib? How do you do this thing? It'll just tell you because it can just go read the documentation and tell you. And you just don't all, even just that, like, it sounds like such a small thing, but that's like the context switching of having to go like you basically just don't have to go to like Stack Overflow anymore, basically, because you can just, in theory, you should be able to just ask this bot. Also as an aside, because I made that comment about thanking Copilot, I do catch myself being like overly polite to the LLMs. Not that it's good to be rude to the LLMs, but I catch myself like I was prompting ChatGPT with something and I used the word please. Then I caught myself and was like, why am I saying please? This is not a being. This is like a large language model with a CLI. Like, why am I saying please? But I guess it's a good habit. Otherwise, maybe you'd get in the reverse habit of just demanding things from people because you're used to talking to your...
You could try A-B testing the quality of the answers based on the quality of your prompt, you know? This is the other thing is like, I'm always curious. I don't use any of these tools for my programming or coding because it's, first of all, I'm not going to pay. Like, I think our company software engineers do use Copilot for some stuff. I don't know the parameters around how they use it. I know that they use it because they'll post screenshots on their Slack channel when funny things happen. Because of course you would.
Of course.
For me, the most of the time that I use it, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you guys, but like I use it as a reverse word search a lot of the time when I'm writing personally and I just want to find a better word for something. A thesaurus is often not that, like a thesaurus can be okay, but sometimes it's just like, for me, it never feels like it has the exact word I'm looking for. And so I'll go to ChatGPT and be like, can you give me a word that like means that, and I'll type a sentence describing a feeling. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure there's a word for this. And then they'll give me like five options and one of them is what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And then also on a whim, sometimes I will just, if I'm about to post a blog post, I'll just like copy it all and throw it in and be like, can you like just like check this for anything really dumb that I missed in proofreading it? And it's you know, I don't know if I'm good at proofreading sufficiently good. It doesn't seem to find that much a lot of the time. But what I'm going to start doing is testing all of them against each other. Because it's like, I have ChatGPT, I can use Google's Gemini, and then a couple of weeks ago, I haven't really used it, but I signed up for Anthropic's Claude. So I do plan on testing them against each other, because I think that's interesting to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did hear recently, I was listening to an interview with Mark Andreessen. For people who don't know, Mark Andreessen is one of the most famous like venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. And where he got his start was that he built the company that built the first web browser, the first useful web browser called Netscape. He also built one called Mosaic that I think was actually purely like a government, like internal thing. Like back when the internet made the jump from like purely institutions talking to each other to public use, he like was involved with the early web browsers for both. But he was saying, so I'm just citing him as a source because I have not validated this, but it's kind of amazing and makes intuitive sense. Is he was saying that I think it was Google or some large company ran like an experiment on how to get the least hallucinatory responses from these LLMs. Because oftentimes if you ask it something that's like a hard question, it wants to give you an answer. So it will make something up, which is obviously not good. You'd rather that it tell you it doesn't know or that it can't, or that it's like, I think one of the most challenging problems they have now is how to get it to have a confidence level and tell you its confidence level. Because I think that would be really helpful. Like if it gives me an answer and it's like, I'm actually not that confident in this answer, then at least you could double check or prompt it differently or something. And apparently in some study that they ran, the way that they got the LLMs to provide the most accurate results was when they started their prompt by saying, take a deep breath. And the explanation that they've come up with is that it has consumed much of human written knowledge on the internet. That's how it has learned. And take a deep breath is shorthand for like, think carefully about this thing and do it carefully. And that because of the way that it has formed its neural net and all of this, that causes it to produce more careful results that hallucinate less, which is kind of fascinating in and of itself. Because it can't breathe.
Yeah.
If you don't know. For those listening at home, it can't breathe.
Oh, man. Sorry, no, this is just making me think of, you could write a new story called I Do Not Have Lungs and I Must Take a Deep Breath.
Oh, I have no lungs yet, I must breathe.
Yes. There we go. But I do think the AI stuff is interesting to talk about, but I did want to touch on like the goals part that you had written in the show notes.
Totally.
I did think I did mention that I do want to learn more for fun. But I think something that both kind of for fun, but also a professional thing that I want to develop is, I guess, working with others or like maybe publishing or getting more into the coding community in a way, because I've never really developed code with somebody else other than, you know, like maybe in some group projects. But all of my coding experience in grad school has been me coding by myself and then just showing somebody the outputs. Like I've never really shown anybody actual parts of my code and had them, give suggestions or anything like that other than, you know, the technical support for the supercomputer. So that's something that I think about a lot. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention and just get it in here is the Stack Exchange post that I linked to, because this is something that I've been thinking about a lot for many, many years, is trying to be more active on these sort of forums. Because the big issue, which I understand why they set it up this way, but the issue with these sort of Stack Exchange forums is that you need to have a certain amount of reputation before you can like upvote or downvote certain answers. But like the issue is the way that you get reputation on these sites is either answering questions or asking them. And it is incredibly rare for me to have a question that I want to ask that isn't already asked on the site. And most of the time, if it's already asked, there's an answer that gives me what I need in order to resolve my issue. And what I wanted, what I would love to be able to do is have enough reputation to just then upvote that answer. So people, you know, later will see that answer more quickly. It'll save them some more time on whatever they're trying to resolve. It's, if it's the same issue. So I had a rare opportunity the other day where I figured out what the issue was based on reading through some answers, but nobody had specifically said the solution that I found. And so I was like, this is an opportunity. I can make a post and I can possibly get some reputation. And if you click on the link, let me know if it actually opens for you, because like I'm logged into my account. I don't know if that makes a difference.
Yeah,
okay, cool. Yeah. So basically what I was doing is I just made a typo when I was trying to do an SSH thing, because I, with the supercomputer, I find it easiest to do like a GitHub RSA where I can just have, you know, that key shared. So then I can have it pull from GitHub instead of me trying to send new versions of the code to the supercomputer every time. And so in order to do this, I actually don't know why, but you need to start with the eval SSH agent command. And you can see here the OP says, you know, they said they came, they had this error, which is the error that I encountered, which is could not open a connection to your authentication agent. And the stuff that they put in the title is something that I also encountered in this when I did the first command that they put here, which is eval, you know, in quotes, SSH agent S. And then you try to add it, because usually when you do that first command, it just tells you like, oh, the PID is set to this six digit number, whatever. Then you add your key, and the idea is that is supposed to be fine, and then you can pull from your GitHub repository and it'll work. But when I tried to do that second one, the SSH add, it said could not open a connection. And so I looked on here, I was like, yeah, okay, that's what I'm typing in. You know, and then they do this whole thing where they're looking at the SSH agent PID or SSH agent authsock, which I find a such a good name for a variable. but then there's a bunch of the people on here with all these answers, and they're talking about, you know, exporting certain variables or, you know, doing sudo commands and all of that. But then what I did is I was looking at the solution that somebody else put, where as part of their solution, they typed in eval and then in double quotes, dollar sign, parenthesis, SSH agent dash S, close parenthesis. And I realized, oh, that's actually what I had typed, because I did this command. I've done this command like multiple times per day for the past several months. And this time it was different. And then I realized like, oh, because I didn't put the dollar sign and the parentheses in. And so I wrote an answer saying, hey, my solution was just to do that instead of, you know, the eval thing. Anyway, so you guys can see the post there, and I, you know, put the error that I got, or, and you know, like the exportation thing. So I was like, hey, this is what I encountered, this is how I fixed it. But then I immediately got, can you guys see the comment on there?
G-Man was not very nice to you.
No.
It seems like he's
wrong. I don't,
he clearly didn't hover over a new contributor, because if you hover over where it says you're a new contributor, it says M. Shea is a new contributor to this site, take care in asking for clarification, commenting and answering, check out our code of conduct. Which basically is a way of saying, like, hey, be nice to this newbie while they're answering stuff. And instead, he chose violence.
This is them being nice. Haven't you been on Stack Exchange before?
I mean, yes.
They even linked to the concept of reputation. They're aware that Mikhail is new.
Yes. No, they are aware that I'm new. But the thing that I'm just confused about is, like, usually people are mean, but they also have a point. This one, I don't know what the point is. Because, like, in the OP's post, they said that this is the thing that they did, the eval command. And okay, yes, they're using single quotes, I'm using double quotes, but like, it doesn't matter. They do the same thing.
Yeah, G-Man's
wrong. Then also, like, I did not say thank you anywhere in my post.
I interpreted that as him saying not to answer him with thank
don't
you.
Respond. Please, no need to thank me.
Oh, that is actually how I interpreted that. I think that's what he meant.
I didn't even think of that. Oh, wow. That's almost,
that makes it worse. Oh, my goodness.
That's amazing.
Because he doesn't want to be bogged down with notifications about your shitty response, apparently. He's got stuff to do. Sorry, you have to bleep that, Mark.
That's worth it.
Oh,
Yeah, anyway, so this is like, this happened this week, but oh my goodness, I really want to be able to be like contribute to this community, because like I think that being able to upvote answers and downvote answers would be super helpful for people who came after me, because there's been so many situations where I'm like, the one that has the most votes is not the one that works.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you just gotta start grinding more.
This is a thing that I've actually considered, is like on my list of things to, you know, projects to consider after I graduate, is like, is there a way that I can kind of, I don't know how else to say this, but like grind or farm for reputation on Stack Exchange so that I can actually then upvote stuff. But anyway, that's a long-winded way for me to just complain about this thing that happened recently and also say like, yeah, I would like to, you know, I guess learn to work with others in this domain to kind of continue professional development in that area.
Yeah, I'm hoping for something similar. I know that we're running kind of long in general this episode, but one last thing that I guess I want to ask you guys for your opinions on is that, like, so in terms of like the split between like professionally and personally, I think we all addressed it accurately, and maybe just like add a wrinkle to that. Like, part of what I think about with like programming outside of like what is explicitly required for your current role, like that's maybe the bounds of what people think professionally means. But I also think like if a technical skill set, meaning specifically programming or coding, is part of your like career capital that you're building as a professional, like there is, many people have strong opinions about like, oh yeah, then you should definitely, like, if you want to continue to grow, then you'll need to spend time outside of like your 40 to 45 professional hours a week. Like that's your professional time where you're focused on stuff at work. But if you want to be like developing your skills, then like you probably need more time on your own projects. Like, not saying you should work on your job 80 hours a week or something, but just that you should be spending time developing your skills. Like, how do you guys think about that? Or is that more like on the back burner? Or like, just would be curious to hear how you guys think about that in terms of coding on things outside of specific work projects.
I just first want to address that I just find it so funny, the idea of like actually working for 40 to 45 hours
a week. I agree.
It's like, oh yeah, the 40 to 45 hours of professional, you know, like time that I'm devoting to my job is like, I maybe put like 20 hours a week in, and I am at the edge of like being able, I could not do more. Like, my brain just cannot output more useful hours.
I mean, yeah, the act of working is always very, like, it's not, I was just having this conversation when we were at headquarters, because we were talking with the newer members of our team. And remember, everyone I work with directly, like who's on my team other than me, is a salesperson.
Yes.
Their conception of the time they need to spend is super different, and how they use their time is very different than how I use my time, just by nature of their jobs, how they're compensated, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But we had to really emphasize to them that, like, look, yes, you should be putting in time, but you need to be careful about how you spend your time, and you need to take care of yourself. Like, on my end, I agree with you, Mikhail. Am I literally sitting down, thinking hard, doing really important work 40 hours a week? No. But it is my job, like, as just like a full-time employee, to be available for at least that amount of time. Sometimes I am doing something kind of idly in case someone needs something from me, but I'm not doing my peak productive work 40 hours a week, because that's crazy. Like, that's always what it's going to be. It's like there's the stuff that requires your immense focus, and then there's the stuff that you need to be like around for, but it's not like you're pushing yourself to your limit the entire time or whatever, because that's just not healthy.
Cal Newport has entered the chat.
Once again.
Yeah. But to answer, I think, the bigger part of your question, Jack, is there definitely are things that I think about in terms of what I need to literally accomplish in order to finish my degree versus what do I actually want to do in order to continue my career. Because there are certain things like, you know, the amount of time that I put into making my code, you know, as readable as it could probably be, and writing documentation for it, like, I don't need to do that. Like, a lot of people, in grad school never do anything like that, which causes so many issues for people down the line. But that's something that I consider to be both work, but also, like, as you put it, my career capital, because it is a skill that I'm trying to develop in doing all of the sort of things that I need to do for work. But I am putting a little bit of extra effort into there to develop those good habits, build those systems. And it's something similar for how I do research. Like, the way I take notes on research papers is I'm putting in much more work than I need to, but I am feeling so vindicated that I started doing this 3 years ago, because it's making me writing my thesis so much easier than other people that I've talked to, because over the years, I've basically, my notes are like each note in my sort of like Zettelkasten system in Obsidian just has like quotes from papers, and I have them all connected together through links and stuff. And so when I'm thinking through trying to write something, I'm like, I know that there was a citation about this topic. Then I just go in there, click through it, find it, easy, put it in there. But it is something that I started making, not thinking like, okay, yes, I think this will help me within my degree, but it's something that if I continue in research, I will just continue doing this. And so I think it's, you know, something that I'm building in order to kind of have more to offer or more to pull on in future projects.
On my end, so much of the stuff that I do in my free time is because I really value having a separation between what I do for work and what I don't do for work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, I've talked about the various random projects I like to do, but you'll notice that those projects don't have like a through line, really. The math thing that I did was actually for work, but I literally wrote it while I was at work. So, you know, same with all the other code I write while I'm at work, that I've written for work, I write it while I'm at work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And outside of that, I just do other stuff. Like, I'm way more interested, like, the fact that I've been able to start using Python again, and Aaron kind of gave me like I had touched the edges of pandas like mm-hmm. years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple years ago, Aaron gave me at my parents' house during Christmas time, and I needed to do some like heavy data manipulation stuff. It needed to be done, and Aaron kind of like reintroduced me back into it. Now I have that under my belt again. I'm way more interested.
One of us.
I'm way more interested in the fact that I can use those skills that I've developed at work to do more baseball analysis, because I'm way more interested in that. Like, I enjoy that so much more, and the concept of joining that kind of community. That's a bigger priority for me, to be honest. Doing things like developing something on the playdate, that's not going to be relevant to anything. That just sounds like fun.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it is like, I have always loved just collecting little skills and just little things that I can do, because I never know when they're going to become relevant. Like, the fact that I've learned how to use desktop publishing software like InDesign actually helped me during the hackathon, because I was just in a position where I was working with some curriculum people, and we were trying to like write up a thing that should have been much more professional, but we hadn't been able to nab any of our designers or marketing people or anything. So I was like, yeah, I'll just try and whip something up so that it's not in a Google Doc and actually looks good. I did a pretty decent job.
Nice.
Got a sweatshirt out of it.
I just like having I like being familiar with a lot of stuff just in case it becomes useful. I never know when it might be, but it's like, it's the same thing that like makes me an asset on a trivia team. It's just the like random bits of knowledge that I accrue. I just really enjoy doing that. So like, this is a real throwback, but several years ago when Mikhail and I were toying around with something on YouTube, and I learned how to use an animation tool to try and build something. I don't know if you remember that, Mikhail.
Yep.
But like, I figured out how to like create an animation. Like, that hasn't come up again. It might sometime though. And at least I have a concept of how it works. It's the same thing. I've gone through the first two chapters of the introduction of probably like three or four different programming languages. Python's still the only one that I know well, but it's like, I'm vaguely familiar with Haskell. I'm vaguely familiar with Rust. Cool. Like I've like toyed around with little things here and there because I just find that it fascinating in and of itself. And then if I want to dive in deeper, I can, but I don't currently think of it as like, for better or for worse, it's not a concerted effort in any one direction.
Sure.
Maybe someday if I feel like I need to do that. But as things currently are with work specifically, I really am more interested in like, what can I just do for myself that makes me feel good? If it helps with work, that's great. If it doesn't, I'm not going to regret that.
Yeah, I think maybe it's the way that I look at it is that from a career perspective, I always like to have like a primary goal or a couple of goals that are like a focus. And so I feel like over the past few years, a lot of that focus has been less technical. It's been developing like everything else around that. And now that I feel like a lot of that has become more rock solid, I'm like, I actually would prefer to move in a direction of learning more technical stuff and like rounding that out, because I'm a big fan of being a generalist. I think being a generalist is kind of underrated. We live in a world of specialization. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something to be said for like, I've had coworkers comment, they're like, we don't know how Jack has done this, but like never has a single topic come up where Jack doesn't know about that topic. It's just like bizarre. They're like, everybody doesn't know some stuff. And I'm like, I don't know lots of stuff. But apparently I know everything you guys know. So you guys got to work on that. You guys got to pick it up.
I've read both everything they teach you in Harvard Business School and everything they don't teach you in Harvard Business School, thus covering all knowledge of humanity.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think that's really an interesting way to look at it, Mark, of just like collecting these skills and like testing out these different tools. I think that that's something that I want to spend more time doing. Like, I think it's nice to have like anchor things that you care about that you go a little deeper on, because time spent is where you get like outsized returns. Like, it's not diminishing returns. It is like outsized returns for time spent. This is something that, speaking of Cal Newport, that he talks about in, So Good They Can't Ignore You, one of his earlier books. Mm-hmm. He talks about like, you know, he makes the comparison of like, when I was in high school, I was in a band and I played the guitar. And then in researching and like doing the research for this book, I talked to this like bluegrass guitarist and I was like, wow, this guy is 1,000 times better than I ever was. And I spent like lots of hours playing the guitar, but it was just like a fundamental difference in how they approached it as a craft. Like, this bluegrass guitarist was really taking like the deliberate practice approach and really pushing himself. And like, I don't know. I find that interesting. You kind of have to find a balance there too, because you don't want to become kind of monomaniacally focused on a single skill, especially to your point, Mark, like if it's a professional skill that you're doing for work and then it bleeds into your personal time, then suddenly your whole life is wrapped up around one thing, which for some people, I think that's also maybe something that people don't appreciate, that when you see a person that's like amazingly good at a thing, you always have to remember like the opportunity cost of that, that there is probably a trade-off somewhere, that like I almost don't want to be the best at anything, because being the best at a thing would require setting everything else aside largely. And I don't think that trade is worth it.
And so much of that is just a matter of like the way that everyone's brain works is different.
Yeah.
I am someone, and I think especially Jack and I are very similar in that. I think you are a more focused person in terms of, like you said, having like a thing that you're working towards than I am. Or at least I have those things, I guess, but they just don't intersect with this conversation specifically. But that's one of the big reasons that I was pretty confident in my choice and haven't really wavered on it to not even, like, I was so close to applying to grad school before I was offered a job at AOPS. And I was like, no, I'm going to take that job, and I don't regret it, because for me personally, I've enjoyed the financial and time flexibility to pursue things that just kind of catch my curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I, not that I couldn't have cultivated the ability to really focus on a thing and grind down on it, but I don't like regret that for me personally. But I know a lot of people who are very different from that. They have no problem, because that's like the thing that they care about is a thing that they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that by any means. It's just like, right, I've never felt like my brain necessarily just fits into that kind of mold.
It's funny that you say that. I actually just last night, Sarah and I were at a like a family friend's birthday party, and I was talking to a professor of physics at McAllister, who was at this party. He was a guy probably like in his late 60s. And I was just talking to him about what I did and what he did. And I was actually talking about like in my short career, I have like kind of jumped around between different things in a little sense where like I'm kind of getting a lot of breadth and working on different things that, and like I was able to make this shift from like, oh, I'm working in this industry, and I just shifted completely over to a different industry and like learned a lot of new stuff as a result because I was kind of stagnating. And it, like, there are foundational skills that are kind of shared across those domains, but it's also like a new domain in a lot of ways. And he kind of like, his response was, he was kind of like wistfully saying like, I couldn't really do that ever. Like, he was kind of just looking back on his career and he's like, I kind of picked a path where like, yeah, I have autonomy to like make changes, but like I've been working in a domain for a long time. Like, he works on a particular domain of things. He works on, like, it was actually kind of fascinating. He was explaining how he's doing research on essentially material science physics research for photovoltaics for solar cells. Mm. And he's using like a light pulse. He's using like a system where you can like deliver a light pulse every 10 femtoseconds, which for people keeping track at home is 10 to the negative 15 seconds. And then he's using, uh-huh, like, he's essentially using this system where he's hitting the material with light and then capturing an image. He's using that word kind of broadly, but like capturing what is happening in the material. And so doing that on the order of like 10 to the negative 15 seconds, he's capturing like, oh, when light hits this material, it has this change in the conductance of the material. Like, it has, like, he's essentially just trying to, he's on like the very cutting edge of improving performance and our understanding of what's happening in a solar cell, which is pretty amazing and awesome. But he was kind of, it's kind of the opposite to your point, Mark. Like, he kind of, he did go all in. He put all his chips on Red 23 and has worked on this one thing his whole career, which is awesome. And he's like, now, I mean, he's probably one of the world experts on this interesting topic that's pretty relevant to the world, but he doesn't have that same autonomy to let his interests pull him in different directions that other people would. And I don't think he regrets that. I think he just kind of, he saw the contrast in our conversation and commented on it, mm-hmm, but it was interesting.
I just wanted to say, kids, stay in school, but realize that you do not need to go to grad school.
Stay in school unless you want to. Until you don't. I love that advice.
Stay in school until you don't need to.
That's my advice I always give people at the rock climbing gym is like, hold on to the holds until you want to let go of them and then grab the next hold. And they're like, that's not helpful. I'm like, but that is what you want to do, isn't it? So it is helpful.
Yeah. And also, like, hey, going back to school later, totally, totally fine thing to do. It might be weird in terms of like societal norms, but like,
yeah, who cares?
It's fine. Can I start this time?
Please.
Sweet. Yeah. Jack, how do you feel? Give me your hot take on sunscreen.
Hmm. Ooh, sunscreen. I will only wear it on occasions where... So, point of reference, Sarah and I were just last weekend, we're in Orange County, California, for a wedding. And we went to Joshua Tree. And I was very happy about the weather we had in Joshua Tree, because it was like low 60s, sunny with no wind. So you could dress with like long sleeves and pants and a hat and stuff to protect yourself from the sun without getting too warm. Because if I can avoid putting on sunscreen, I would like to. Part of the reason for that is that it's just kind of annoying to put on. And I don't really burn. Sarah put on sunscreen, but I don't really burn unless I'm out in the sun for a while in particular conditions. And my other concern that's a little more of like a crunchy granola thing is that when you look into what's in sunscreens, they're not awesome for you. So if you can avoid putting on sunscreen by doing something else that's an alternative safety measure, because I'm not saying that sun can't be bad for you. Obviously, sun can be bad for you. Sunburns suck, and the consequences of sun exposure can be much worse than a sunburn. But if you can put yourself in a situation where instead you just wear like light covering clothing that provides protection from the sun in some way, then I would prefer to do that. But sunscreen, obviously, amazing thing. Without it, my wife would be peeling, and that would be unpleasant for everybody. So it's good. I don't know about two thumbs up, but it's a good thing. Glad somebody came up with that.
All right.
Tum, rum, tum, tum, tum. Mark.
Thank you for heralding me in.
Sorry, no red carpet. Budget cuts. Mark, what is your hot take on... That's really funny. I'm looking through this. I still have this document that Greg gave me with topics for hot takes. And one of them, I like prescient enough, is Google Chrome grouped tabs. And now I'm just thinking about the tab trees from Mozilla Firefox. that just totally derailed me. Okay, what is your hot take on karaoke?
We did karaoke last year for Aaron's birthday. And my first time ever doing it. Once I just, you know, it's one of those things where you have to, like, be in with a group that you're comfortable with, and you need a couple of champions of karaoke who are, like, totally into it, and that way it just, like, relieves any pressure that someone like me, who is, like, a musical and stuff, but I don't often enjoy singing in front of other people. But I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. We did it in a private room to start. I think we spent, like, I don't remember if we had it for an hour or 2 hours. I don't remember how long we had it for. It must have been 2 hours, but maybe it wasn't. Either way, we were in a private room, which was definitely preferable. It was very loud. That kind of surprised me, actually, the way that they crank up the volume in there. But it was fun. Like, I understand why people enjoy it. Now, the public karaoke side, that would have been too much for me. We did stay for it, and, like, Aaron did a couple. Some of her friends did a couple. Like, all well and good for them to enjoy doing that. That would not be my vibe at all. I don't think I would ever do public karaoke. Maybe not ever, but, like, it'd be a tough sell. I would have to be in exactly the right mood for it. So even if it doesn't totally vibe with how I operate, I understand it. I give it a thumbs up. People have fun with it. It's good, harmless fun. And I think that's important.
That was a beautiful message at the end.
Yeah.
Mikhail, what is your hot take on cable ties?
There's some circumstances where they're really nice. For example, I use the cheaper version of a cable tie, which is just an elastic that you tie to one end of the cable. And then when you wrap it all up, then you can pull the elastic around and then it just stays wrapped up. I think for certain cables, there are certain situations where I feel like I have seen people use them, where in reality, at least for me, it just never makes a whole lot of sense, like tying them to certain objects where you might need to, like, I don't know, like part of your desk so that you always have a charging cable available. And at least for my setup, I find if I do that, it's just more hassle than it's worth to have to undo the cable tie, pull out the cable so that you can use it, and then when you put it back, wrap it back up. But I do really appreciate cable ties for things like, actually, the mic that I'm using right now, it's a lapel mic, and I have a cable tie so that when I wrap it all up, I can put it back in its bag, because there is like an extension cable also in that bag, which is also cable tied, but because they are both cable tied, they don't get tangled with each other. So I think that is something that I really appreciate about it, is if you have some sort of cable tie situation, whether that's, you know, one of the fancy Velcro things, or, you know, an elastic, or sometimes I'll just wrap stuff in tape if I know that I'm not going to use it a lot. I really appreciate not having tangled cables. That's more for storage, rather than just like constant use. That's it.